sometimes you need to reprioritize defense spending. And nobody can tell me that this hasn't become a priority.
Amid escalating rhetoric over North Korea, are more missile defense systems worth the cost? From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Fairbanks police confront staffing shortages and worsening violent crime.
Body armor taped around his arms, taped around his legs, and a ballistic or bulletproof face mask.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Day by day, the leaders of the U.S. and North Korea are ratcheting up the threats of fiery destruction. The missile defense system based at Fort Greely, southeast of Fairbanks, is intended to shield the entire nation from attack. The system has had a spotty test record, but U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan says he has confidence in it. In fact, as Alaska Public Media's Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports, Sullivan wants Congress to invest in more anti-ballistic missiles at Fort Greely.
Sullivan is one of the Senate's biggest boosters of missile defense. He's been warning that one day, through news reports or from intelligence agencies, we would learn the threat is at our doorstep.
And when that happens, we want to make sure our leaders have the capacity and the capability and the strategic time and space to say, America, whether it's Anchorage or Chicago or New York, we got you covered.
Sullivan says this is that day. This is the scenario he's been warning about. So how sure is he that America is covered?
I'm confident, but we can do more.
He sponsored a bill to increase the number of interceptors at Fort Greely by 28. That's on top of the 40 that are already paid for. Each missile costs roughly $80 million, so this is a multi-billion dollar proposal. Sullivan says he's not sure exactly where the money for the expansion would come from.
But it's a good question, right? Because obviously the defense budget is limited. What I was arguing in the committee as we were marking this bill up was that sometimes you need to reprioritize defense spending. And nobody can tell me that this hasn't become a priority.
Whether it comes at the expense of other defense spending or from somewhere else in the budget, Sullivan says missile defense is a good value.
You know, buying that kind of insurance for everybody, not just Alaska, but for every city in America, to me is a price that almost any American would want to pay.
To date, the U.S. has spent about $40 billion on its ground-based missile defense system. It's designed to destroy an enemy missile in space before it begins descending toward North America. But the system has had technical problems. It has failed to intercept a Mach warhead in about half of its last 18 tests. Sullivan says the Missile Defense Agency is addressing the problems. Besides, he says, the U.S. has more than one interceptor it can shoot at a North Korean launch, so even without an expansion, he believes the missile shield would work.
So I'm confident, but we should have a belt and suspenders approach to this.
Not very confident at all.
Phil Coyle is a former assistant defense secretary who was in charge of operational testing and evaluation at the Pentagon. He's now a senior fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Looking at the tests since the start of 2010, Coyle says the success rate of the system at Fort Greely is only 40%.
Meaning it misses out of 10 tries, it would miss six of those.
Coyle agrees with Sullivan that the U.S. would aim multiple interceptors at a single missile. But he says the strategy hasn't been tested, and the enemy missile would only be in space for a limited time. He says he's not entirely familiar with Sullivan's bill. Parts of it aim to advance the technology, and Coyle says they may be good. But he cautions against building more of the same defensive missiles we already have.
The problem with with building more and more interceptors, especially if they don't work very well to start with, is you just encourage the enemy to build more and more offensive missiles to attack us so that they can overwhelm our defenses.
A different U.S. missile defense system has performed better in tests. That system is called THAAD, Terminal High Altitude Area Defense. A test interceptor launched from Kodiak last month hit the target. But even if THAAD were deployed in Alaska permanently, it wouldn't do much good. Coyle and other experts say that system can't protect from an overseas launch. It's designed to knock out slower, shorter-range missiles and to protect a smaller area. He says it would take thousands of THAAD missiles planted everywhere to protect the U.S. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The Fairbanks Police Department remains understaffed despite a recently approved hiring bonus. Police Chief Eric Jukes told City Council members this week the substandard pay is driving high turnover and making recruiting difficult. And while a new labor contract is being contested in court, Jukes says the short-staffed department must deal with a spike in violent crime. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Jukes told council members in Monday's meeting that statistics show the rate of violent crime in Fairbanks is well above the national average. And he says his officers have been on the receiving end of that violence several times so far this year. Like when they confronted a heavily armored man on June 19th who charged at them firing an assault rifle after they'd cornered him in a field on the city's south side.
A gunman with soft body armor, rigid hard plates over top of that covering his torso. Body armor taped around his arms, taped around his legs, and a ballistic or bulletproof face mask.
Police shot 20-year-old Matthew Stover to death, and the case is still under investigation. That was one of four officer-involved shootings so far this year, including one that followed the fatal shooting of Sergeant Alan Brandt. Jukes himself was among four officers who returned fire on a man who led police on a high-speed chase around South Fairbanks and east of town on May 25th until he was blockaded at the Mitchell Expressway on-ramp to the Richardson Highway.
That's the environment in which we're asking them to work.
Troopers ruled the deadly force used against 23-year-old Sean Buck was justified because Buck reportedly was shooting at police and ramming their vehicles with a stolen truck he was driving. That case also remains under investigation. Jukes says the recent spike in violent crime locally is reflected in seven murders in the city that have occurred through July, compared with eight in all of last year.
In 7 months, that puts us on par to have 12 this year.
Based on that calculation, Jukes says 12 murders in a city of 33,000 would greatly exceed the national murder rate, according to data from the FBI's Uniform Crime Reports, or UCR, which annually lists the rates of crime in cities and states per 100,000 population.
That equates to 36.4 per 100,000, or 7.5 times the national average.
Jukes says the UCR shows violent crime occurs twice as frequently in Alaska compared with the national average, even more so for assault and rape.
The U.S. average for aggravated assaults per 100,000 people, 237. The Alaska average is 497. U.S. average for rape is 38.6. The Alaska average is 122.
The chief told council members he's trying to fill six vacant positions, and he said most of the other 40 or so officers must work mandatory overtime to help staff those and seven other positions that'll be filled once the new recruits graduate from the academy. So he says in the meanwhile, the department's also hard-pressed to deal with lesser offenses.
Lower-level crimes are often a struggle to investigate because the limited number of officers are inundated with more serious calls.
Council members thanked Jukes for his talk, but couldn't offer much more than encouragement. That's mainly because the city's awaiting a decision from the Alaska Supreme Court on a dispute over a new contract the council approved in 2014 that would have boosted pay and benefits. The council later rescinded the contract over a concern it was too generous. The Public Safety Employees Association, which represents the police, then sued, claiming breach of contract. And most observers say a ruling on that case isn't likely anytime soon. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Anchorage logged its 17th and 18th homicides of the year in less than 2 hours last night. Police say they believe the two deaths were unrelated, and though there have been no arrests in either killing, Anchorage residents should not be alarmed. MJ Tim is a police spokesperson.
We understand their concerns, but we want to reassure that we are working to close these cases, but that this time there is no threat to the public.
Tim says it was a little before 9 last night when someone shot the woman in the Spinard neighborhood. He says detectives think the shooting was drug-related.
She was shot and struck by a vehicle fleeing the scene.
The vehicle struck a multiplex close by. Officers interviewed the driver, and while it was unclear if that person was connected to the shooting, Tim says the driver was released without charges. Police are withholding the woman's name pending notification of her next of kin. Tim says investigators have no suspect information to release. Then, Tim says, shortly before 11 p.m., police responded to a 911 call and found a man bleeding from multiple stab wounds near Midtown.
Investigators believe that the victim and the parties involved were homeless. Indications are this is an isolated incident and not random.
Tim did not give a possible motive for the stabbing and says investigators also have no suspect information to release, nor have they made any arrests. Nearly 30 people were injured on a tour in Skagway on Wednesday. According to a press release from the city, a Unimog touring vehicle went off the road at Alaska Excursions dog camp around 11 a.m. The Skagway company offers tours of a mushers camp in Dyea. The fire department and EMS volunteers responded to the scene of the accident at 10 Mile Dyea Road. 28 people were transported to the local Dahl Memorial Clinic. 25 were treated and released. 3 were medevaced to receive further treatment. According to the clinic's executive director, Shelley O'Boyle, injuries ranged from bumps and bruises to several broken bones and a few head injuries. The clinic's emergency plan was activated to respond to the accident. It's the first time that measure has been taken in a couple of years. In 2014, 23 people were injured when a White Pass and Yukon Route railroad train derailed. The fire department and municipality declined to provide any information beyond the limited press release. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what will it take to keep Alaska's economy strong in the future?
Mother, may I have, you know, a gajillion dollars to do that, right? So, you know, as you might imagine, that one didn't really land well.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
When the giant oil field at Prudhoe Bay was discovered in 1968, it held more oil than anyone in Alaska had dared to imagine. But today, Prudhoe and the other legacy fields on the North Slope aren't producing oil like they used to. That's an economic problem for the state, but it's also an engineering problem. This summer, Alaska's Energy Desk is bringing you a series called Midnight Oil, about the state's long and complicated love affair with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. In our last installment, Elizabeth Harbaugh asks, what's the future of the pipeline and the state that depends on it?
Today, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline is carrying a little over 500,000 barrels of oil per day. That's a quarter of what it did in its heyday. And that's creating some challenges. To learn what kind of challenges exactly, another reporter and I dropped by the Anchorage offices of Alyeska Pipeline Service Company.
Wait for it.
There, some Alyeska engineers showed us a surveillance video from a pump station along the pipeline.
Yeah. Oh my God! Wait, what are we looking at here?
What we are looking at is footage of a giant hunk of thick black wax. It's been pushed at a section of the pipeline like toothpaste squeezed from a tube, and it is huge. 20 feet long, 4 feet tall, guys in protective suits and respirator masks are hacking away at it with picks and shovels. This is technically called a wax event, but pipeline engineer Tom Marcazzani has a different name for it.
The big Tootsie Roll, we like to call it.
It's an extreme example of what can happen as less oil moves down the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. With less oil, it moves more slowly and starts to cool. As it cools, wax in the oil solidifies and drops out, gunking up the pipe and sometimes forming the world's biggest, most unappetizing Tootsie Rolls. And that's just one of many things that start to go wrong. Rob Annett is an engineer with Alyeska. He says as the amount of oil drops, it starts to raise some existential questions.
Is there some sort of, potentially, a tipping point where the way you've always done it doesn't work anymore?
Alyeska thinks there is a tipping point. A 2011 study put it somewhere around 300,000 barrels a day. Below that point, they're not sure how the pipeline will work, or if it will work. State and federal forecasts predict it will approach that threshold in the next decade. So a couple years ago, the company called in Annett and told him to form a team. Their task? Figure out how to keep the pipeline going. For the past few years, Annett and his crew have considered all kinds of crazy ideas. Even the craziest idea of all, building a whole new, smaller oil pipeline. The current pipeline is 4 feet wide, built for the state's boom times. A smaller line would let today's lower volumes run faster and stay warmer.
Mother, may I have, you know, a gajillion dollars to do that, right? So, you know, as you might imagine, that one didn't really land well.
Obviously, a new pipeline doesn't pencil out. So they're exploring other ideas, like super high-tech pipe scrapers that might remove wax more efficiently, or maybe injecting some kind of antifreeze. Other ideas they couldn't even tell us about. The team hasn't found their silver bullet yet, and the clock is ticking. But in the end, Annett says the future of the pipeline isn't up to engineers.
I think the end game is not going to be strictly technical. I think it's going to be, you know, an economic viability for the people who own the pipeline.
The people who own the pipeline. That would be the top three oil companies in Alaska, BP, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil. All the solutions Annett's team dreams up come at a price. Someday, someone in an office building somewhere will run the numbers and decide there's just not enough oil flowing to justify the cost to keep the pipeline running. That reality, coupled with a dive in oil prices, is forcing Alaska to confront an uncomfortable question. What happens when we can't count on oil money any longer? Larry Persily is a close observer of the oil and gas industry. He doesn't think the pipeline is going to shut down anytime soon, but he does believe that as production declines, Alaska will shrink.
Not geographically, but in terms of jobs and population and the size of the economy, I just don't see a way out of it.
But when you talk to people in the oil industry and to plenty of Alaska's elected officials, there is a way out of it. Find more oil. And they could be right. In the past year, there have been three potentially major oil discoveries in Alaska. One company, Kalis Energy, thinks it's found 6 billion barrels of oil on the North Slope. I spoke to Kalis' CEO, Jim Musselman, right after his company announced the discovery last October.
There's just lots of oil yet to be discovered here. And that's what I want to make sure and reiterate to the people of Alaska. Don't give up here. There's a lot to be found. And if you'll just work with us, we'll find a lot more oil for you yet.
But developing a new oil field in the Arctic is risky and expensive. This spring, Kalis put off its next steps, citing low prices and changes to the state's oil taxes. Alaska can't ignore the possibility of new discoveries, but the state can't count on them either. So some Alaskans are betting on a different kind of future. There's a new startup culture in Alaska, with more interest and support than ever before. John Bittner heads up the Alaska Small Business Development Center. He acknowledges that today's startups aren't likely to be the next BP and ConocoPhillips.
I mean, individually, no. None of these industries is going to replace oil. It can't. But in aggregate, this is how you transform an economy.
Bittner says we should see the oil years as a gift.
We got a jump start that nobody predicted, and now it's up to us to run with it.
Ultimately, Bittner says, it's Alaskans who have to decide if this is the beginning of the end or the prelude to a transformation. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage. This story was produced with Rachel Waldholz.
This story was adapted from Midnight Oil, a podcast from Alaska's Energy Desk. To hear more about what may be ahead for Alaska, check out the full episode at alaskapublic.org or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. And by
ExxonMobil Alaska, whose goal is safe and responsible operations of the Point Thompson facility. ExxonMobil, energy lives here.
After last week's Nunavut, Alaska Constitutional Convention in Bethel, concerns were raised in the community about what comes next. KYUK's Christine Trudeau reports.
What a group of representatives from roughly 13 of the 56 Yukon-Kuskokwim tribal villages were able to do as they convened was agree to hold a vote come November 7th. In the provisional government's first press release, they say that a, quote, ballot will also show candidates for president, vice president, and clerk, as well as a vote for a united government. But that's a tough road ahead. Over the 3 days the provisional government met, they were only able to touch on a few topics, such as land jurisdiction, taxation, education, health care, and the courts, along with various specific issues impacting the YK Delta, like domestic violence. These are all areas attendees said they hope to improve under a united government once one is created. But on the KYUK Friday call-in show talk line, several callers voiced their concerns, some anonymously, that not all 56 tribal villages were represented, that 13 villages did not represent a quorum. Some callers said that translated as taking action without majority consent.
I like the vision, all right, but how they're trying to introduce themselves is just, it's just not right.
The Nunavut Provisional Government did not set about creating a government body for the region's villages just yet. That would only come about if tribal citizens of the 56 villages in the YK Delta approve it during the proposed November 7th vote.
Like one of the elders sit here, we're a sleeping giant. Our region controls the AFN, majority of our people, but we are fragmented.
That's George Guy with Gwiflik Incorporated. Even the new government's name, Nunavut, for instance, which means our land, is just a placeholder until 56 tribal village citizens vote on it. I'm Christine Trudeau.
Two specially equipped sailboats are attempting a voyage that's never been done before, a trip to the North Pole. Led by a British explorer, the international crew has moved the boats from their home in Sitka up to Nome, where they're hoping to launch for their journey to the pole this weekend. Melting sea ice in the Arctic could make their voyage possible for the first time in history. KCAW's Emily Kwong reports.
The North Pole has long been locked in ice. But climate change is breaking the Arctic apart, turning a polar landscape into something far more friendly for boats. Like the Snow Dragon 2. With its big white sail, the yacht looks like a pleasure craft, but is sturdy enough to collide with sea ice at full speed without breaking apart. Explorer Penn Haddo is actually taking two boats on this trip. The Snow Dragon with its aluminum hull, and the Bagheera, which is made of steel. He hopes their journey will send a powerful message to world leaders that something isn't right at the top of the world.
We are not going to be able to carry on mindlessly taking whatever we want from the environment. And I think a lot of people are looking to this as a symbol for a new debate.
Because if two sailboats can get there, a whole universe of economic activity opens up around shipping and fishing. Both Russia and Denmark have filed claims for the North Pole, and other countries want to expand their Arctic territory too. Unlike the South Pole, the North Pole has no legal protections. Haddo wants to shine a spotlight on the vulnerability of this region by being the first to get there.
It is a strange challenge and ambition indeed, working very hard to put together a project that you don't actually want to succeed.
Because success means the ice is going or gone. Haddo calls the project Arctic Mission. His crew of 10 includes lead scientist Tim Gordon, who will collect data from creatures both well-known and mysterious.
When the ice melts, polar bears struggle to hunt seals, but there's a lot going on beneath the waves that we know much less about.
There's bacteria, plankton, and other species living in frigid temperatures and total darkness. In studying them, Gordon wants to create a snapshot of how human action is changing the world.
Now that the ice is melting, they are all of a sudden going to be exposed to commercial fishing, to commercial shipping, to a whole wave of new competitor animals that will come in.
In other words, Gordon says the whole food chain could be altered without ice to protect the region. There's broad scientific consensus that the Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
About a third of the salmon caught in Alaska gets shipped to China for processing. But a recent consumer study suggests that at least some of that wild salmon should stay in the Chinese markets. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Angie Jung didn't grow up eating much salmon near her hometown of Beijing, China. When she did, she ate farm salmon, prepared raw, sashimi style.
After I moved up to Alaska, I realized wild salmon, because this is different than the farm-raised salmon, which is dominating in China market.
Jung is now an associate professor of economics at the University of Alaska Anchorage. And she says most Chinese consumers are familiar with Alaska salmon. It's been popularized by fish oil pills for decades, but few have ever dined on it. What you can find in China markets is farm salmon from places like Norway and Chile. Jung came across wild Alaska salmon only once in a market in Hong Kong, and that salmon was over $50 a pound.
That's very expensive. So that triggered me to think, if we can export more Alaska wild salmon to China market, especially the large mainland market, definitely there is a potential.
Most of the wild salmon that's sent to China is processed and shipped back to the U.S. or onto Europe. Jung says almost none of it stays in China. So she wanted to know if Chinese consumers would be interested in eating it rather than just exporting. For her recent study, she had graduate students interview shoppers at 30 different stores in three large Chinese cities. And they found that, yes, the majority would buy wild Alaska salmon, just not at such a steep price. Jung says if more of that fish were to hit the stores, it could ultimately lower the cost. Still, she thinks that part of what's driving the new interest is China's changing demographics. More Chinese are joining the middle class, and they want to know where their food comes from.
Due to the environmental pollution and the number of food safety scandals in China in recent years, the consumers also have growing concerns about food safety and the possible contamination of their food supply.
Jung says when people in China imagine Alaska, they think pristine waters. But there's still a ways to go before the salmon actually shows up in the stores. Jung thinks small seafood processors across the state should form a coalition to explore the option. And in a few years, wild Alaska salmon sashimi could start popping up on the menu in China. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Abby Collins in Haines, Casey Grove, Elizabeth Harbaugh, and Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Christine Trudeau in Bethel, Emily Kwong in Sitka, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Zachariah Hughes produced tonight's program. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Midnight Oil is brought to you with generous support from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.